I want to begin by apologizing to my discussant as I've reconstructed my remarks continuously over the course of the day, and they may bear very little relationship to the written document that is in his possession. In the taxi on the way over to this neighborhood from St. Pancras yesterday, the following conversation occurred. "So what are you in town for?" I said, "I'm giving a talk tomorrow at the House of Lords." "Oh," he said, "on what?" I said, "Inequality in power." "At the House of Lords?" And then when I walked in this morning, at the gentleman who greeted me downstairs, I asked for the seminar on inequality in power. He said, "No power here, it's all gone to Brussels." And then when I came in and we started the conversation, there was a discussion of the triadic nature, three dimensions of the concept of power. And what immediately occurred to me is that, yes, indeed, this is very apropos. And in a concrete sense, the triadic dimensions of power were and are the International Monetary Fund, the European Commission, and the European Central Bank. And I'll come back to that. But since we need to talk a little bit about the relationship between power and economics, I'm surprised that no one has so far quoted the essential seven-word sentence in The Wealth of Nations on the subject. And Adam Smith, I think, gives the best and most succinct comment on the entire topic that I've ever seen. He simply said, "Wealth, as Mr. Hobbes says, is power." Something for the political scientists and philosophers, as well as for the economists. Wealth, as Mr. Hobbes says, is power. Once you draw that equation between wealth and power, I think you have converted the conceptual framework from a categorical one, or one which is of direct coercive control of a higher over a lower level, into something that has an affinity with the concept of standing and with the concept of status and hierarchy itself. Thorstein Veblen is another authority on the topic who has not yet been cited today. Veblen, of course, begins his analysis in the theory of the leisure class by noting that the concept of property arises first in the possession of women as chattel, and then, and by extension, other forms of slavery, extends with the development of material life to the collection and accumulation of objects, because obviously the people are collectible before objects exist to be collected, and then moves from there to abstract units of control. And so you get conspicuous consumption, conspicuous waste, conspicuous leisure, other forms of pecuniary emulation, to which one would have to add in our own day the concept of competitive or conspicuous philanthropy, that is to say, the display of one's status in society, not so much by accumulating wealth, but by showing how much you have accumulated by giving it away in a suitably dramatic form. And what this demonstrates is that the ultimate expression of status is not wealth itself, but the power that wealth can buy, because the point of conspicuous philanthropy is to reestablish power, and it becomes the final, expression of social distinction. When you look at this in terms of market structure, it becomes apparent that the two concepts are, again, very closely related. Concentration is power. And this is very, very clear when looking at the banking system. The larger and the fewer the units, the greater the status of those who are at the top of each particular institution. Deconcentration, on the other hand, is, by definition, power sharing. And the point of the program of breaking up the banks, which Robert alluded to as a kind of right-wing approach to the financial crisis, is not, in fact, to achieve something close to the perfectly competitive model because all of these deconcentrated banks would in fact behave like each other with electronic communications. They would simply become smaller elements in a large herd. It is to reduce the banks as individual units to a scale that can be regulated effectively by governmental units, as the very large banks cannot be, and therefore to create a balance or an effective countervalence of power between the public sector and the private financial sector. That, I think, is the legitimate argument for banks on a smaller scale. Smaller banks mean smaller bankers with lower spans of control and less pay, and it would take more of them to fit into Larry Summers' office, and any group of 13 would have less weight in the overall economy than the particular group that happened to show up on that day that was so fateful in the life of Brooksley Bourne. And the same thing is true, by the way, when you look at political units. The scale of the units is essential to their power. That is obviously true of the Age of Empires and our own time of the United States, the late USSR, China in our day, and that particular collection of smaller countries known as Europe. It's an obvious point that the existence of the ability to play as a powerful entity on the world stage is a direct function of the scale of political organization. The same principle is true for corporate units and for other forms of economic organization. The economist who I think cannot be beat on this subject as providing the essential framework for the analysis is Simon Kuznets, whose argument was, as you will recall back in the 1950s, that if you started from an economy of small agricultural freeholders and you start to build cities and industries, you were going to get a period of rising concentration, increasing inequality of income and wealth, and that would be followed, however, in due course as the previously egalitarian agricultural sector declines in relative weight, by the creation of institutions that provide for a subsequent deconcentration of power, decentralization, the rise of a political democracy, of a middle class, of the social welfare state, produce ultimately a reduction in inequality in the context of an industrialized and urbanized society. I think, and I have argued, that Kuznets would have been quite comfortable, at least in the post-Cold War framework, which would permit one to express this view without having the constraints of the power struggle that was going on in the 1950s, with the idea that his concept of inequality being a function of intersectoral transitions in both scale and relative income, different major sectors, taking a new turn as the world economy develops, and in particular in the age of globalization, what one gets and what one observes is a rise in inequality, which is associated with the specialization in particular sectors, particularly advanced technology and finance, by a small number of countries at the top of the structure, and therefore a turn upward of the right tail of what was formerly the inverted Kuznets curve. And of course, the sector, as Adair has already pointed out, that tends to be predominant at that upward tail in those countries which are able to project their dominance in the sector is the financial sector. And I can show you some work that I have done. I just don't want to spend too much time on my own work, but this is my effort to achieve status by quantification has been to create what I believe to be the largest and I think most reliable, consistently comparable set of data on household income inequality, estimated household income inequality, that's presently available in the world. It has just shy of 4,000 observations over 50 years, which is, if you know anything about these data sets, it's between 4 and 8 times larger than what's available from other sources. This is a pattern, and you can see the cool colors are relatively egalitarian, the hot ones are the more unequal areas for the 1960s, and you can see how the world is transformed through the 1980s and the 1990s with the unequal regions coming increasingly predominant. Come on, let's go. There's the 1990s. We bring in the data for the post-Soviet states, and you can see the world as it is in the 2000s, with just a very small number of countries that are approaching the level of equality that was characteristic of a great many of them in the 1960s. So you have a global pattern of rising inequality. What you have, let's see, that's not going to show. I'm sorry, translating to the computer. For the United States, is something which very clearly, well, it doesn't illustrate anything clearly, but the, those two are not going to work. I will pass on. What the U.S. data show is that the rise in inequality is very heavily related to, as everyone knows, the incomes of the very top strata. This is true whether you look at income tax data, you look at income distributed across counties, or you do it the way we do it, looking at income distributed from earnings as distinct from total income. And what you find is that the movement of income inequality very closely tracks the movement of asset prices into the stock market. So it's clearly income flowing into the hands of people who own assets according to the changing relative prices of assets. If you break out, and this I can show you, the income inequality across all of the regions of Europe, about 252 of them, across into six major sectors, what this chart shows you is that the contribution of finance to the inequality of Europe is very, very substantial. That's the big blue bar, and it just dominates everything else. So it's essentially confirming in a slightly different way that the analysis that Adair was giving you just a few minutes ago. And if you do the same exercise across the regions, you discover that it's not hard to figure out where the financial incomes are being earned. That blue bar at the bottom of the chart with the largest single contribution by a very large margin, except for Paris, is the city of London. So here we are. Oh, and then I'll pass on that, but I just put that in there because it came up as part of the discussion earlier. Two old lions whose names have already been mentioned in the conversation. Let me just pass now to the question I have one other point, which is that it seems to me on the general issue, it seems to me that this bears on the discussion that we were having earlier about credit and about, let's say, about the relationship between micro foundations and macroeconomics. Because finance is quintessentially an institutional presence in the economy. And the disappearance of finance from the models, which, as Adair again said a few minutes ago, made it impossible to understand what was going on in the great economic collapse after 2007, is an artifact of the disappearance of institutions generally from the models. That is to say, of the Samuelsonian approach to which we alluded earlier, of building a mechanical macroeconomics on top of a foundation of purely competitive microeconomics while ignoring the institutional structures that are implicit and distinctive to each individual economy, of which the financial sector is perhaps the most important, prominent, present example. And I would argue that the division of economics into macro and micro that goes back 50 years, is in fact a culpable force behind this failure of understanding, because part of the purpose of that division was to remove academic space which had previously been accorded to institutionalist analysis. And if you look back at the history, particularly of economics in the United States, an entire tradition of which my father was the last really preeminent example has largely been erased from history as thoroughly as Trotsky was erased from photographs in the early Soviet Union. This has a special bearing, it seems to me, on the particular way that Europe has been constructed. Because following, in some respects, the pattern of prior pattern of intellectual construction and deconstruction, Europe has been built around the erosion, the deconstruction, if you like, of previously existing institutional structures, of which the first would have been the nation state, that is to say, which gave up its sovereignty over monetary policy and a great deal of its control over fiscal policy in stages through the adoption of the single currency and the acceptance of common criteria for debt and deficits in relation to GDP. And while the social functions of the European states were allegedly left to be part, to be decided according to the preferences of their individual political constituencies, the fact is that as time goes on, those too have been increasingly deconstructed in the wake of the crisis, aggressively deconstructed by the assertion of a central control whose policy direction has been toward the systematic dismantling of welfare state protections and public pension systems and other institutions that have provided a common foundation for, let's say, common expression of the social, of the welfare state in the various European countries. This has also entailed a kind of collectivization of political views and a disciplining of democracy and an increasingly intolerance of diversity of political expression, right? And that's not a problem so long as, broadly speaking, the societies involved are engaged in a common project which is moving the vast majority of their populations toward shared objectives, but it becomes a issue of some drama, a dramatically increased importance in time of crisis when it begins to be clear to at least part of the political spectrum in European countries that the previous models, the existing models of economic governance, are formulas for disaster, that they are leading toward the destruction of the societies and cultures that they purport to govern. And that is the situation which has been emerging for the last 6 years in the south of Europe. The power over, let's say, the decision in these matters seems to be passing, and the interesting question is to whom or where is it passing? And here I want to offer two interpretations, two possibilities, which I think the facts of the matter remain to be resolved. One of the possibilities would follow the line of analysis that you could find in my father's 1967 book, The New Industrial State, which coined the term the technostructure. And my father's argument, which again is as I mentioned earlier today, the great undeveloped area that he sought to interject into economics, was that in large organizations, the processes and distribution of power are fundamentally different than they are in competitive markets. That power passes not to the person in control of the organization, but to the functionaries and officials who carry out its various technical and scientific functions, and that when power passes to the organization, as he wrote, it passes irrevocably. Well, you have as part of one of the let's say the establishment of credentials to be a technostructure, a certain number of criteria, and these two have already had some discussion earlier today. Quantitativity, I think, is a very important one, and it shows up in the technical teams that form the what was formerly known as the Troika, the triad of power expression in Europe, in a number of interesting ways. One of them, of course, is the Maastricht criteria, a technical expression of an ideological goal. In the specific case of the Greek program that was accepted by the previous governments, the key quantitative goal was a goal of a primary surplus of 4.5% over an indefinite period of time in order to establish what was imagined to be fiscal and debt sustainability. It's now apparent that the promulgation of that goal was simply a device by the previous Greek government to, let's say, mollify the technical teams and to get the German government on board in support of the program, while it had no intention and no capacity to implement any of the other reforms that were being asked of it. Right? And none of them, in fact, were implemented before the election that replaced that government with a new government in January that brings a very different point of view and, in fact, a very clear-cut critique of the entire economic and political structure to power in Athens. So we have a very interesting phenomenon to which I want to close by calling your attention to it, because I have been involved with it rather intimately for the last several months, in fact, for the last several years.
Sorry to interrupt. So the technostructure, you said there were two...
Oh, the alternative. Sorry. The alternative is that power may be vested in the leadership of an individual country, in this particular case of Germany. And the interesting test, sorry, I missed that point. It's right here in my notes, but the notes are rather, let's say, written over. The test in point of fact is whether it is possible for the leader of a particular country and the dominant country in the European system to exercise effective control over her own technostructures. Okay? And we have a clear, I think, difference of final objectives in that respect, insofar as Chancellor Merkel understands quite well that the larger strategic future of Europe depends upon it holding together as a single political and economic entity, that the start of fragmentation would be followed by further fragmentation and an immense loss of international prestige. But on the other hand, you have in the technostructure lots of very different competing objectives, including a desire to maintain and validate their previous economic program, and a desire also in certain respects to simply destroy the government of Greece and to replace it with one which is more malleable, that is to say, a government such like that of Mario Monti in Italy a few years ago, a technocratic government, or the government that replaced George Papandreou in Greece before the Samaras came in. So there's all of those possibilities are out there, and the question of which will prevail is very much up in the air as we speak. What's interesting about the rebellion that has occurred in Greece is that, first of all, it is very strongly based on the evidence of experience, on a conviction that if a policy has not worked on a five-year period, it probably will never work and may have been designed for entirely ulterior purposes, such as asset grabbing and debt collection, rather than economic recovery on the restoration of a viable economy in Greece. It is a rebellion which is not ideologically threadbare, as populist uprisings sometimes are, but in this case, very heavily articulated over many years by figures who are now the dominant figures in the government in Greece. I think in those respects, it's really quite a heroic moment. It may well be a doomed moment, because it's not at all obvious that there is room in the European system for governments with fundamentally different perspectives on economic policy to coexist with the existing and previously existing institutional framework. The technocracy, the technostructure, may not be able or willing to accommodate itself to that. And if that is the case, then the victim is the concept of democracy itself, that there is essentially no meaning to a process of democratic choice which does not allow a country to make its own decisions. Where that stands as of today is that, as of last week, the Greek government decided that the discussions that were going on with the technical teams were essentially unproductive, and that this had to be moved to the political level. You may have read in the Financial Times today that Prime Minister Tsipras sent a very detailed letter describing the entire situation to Chancellor Merkel. Her response was an immediate invitation to Berlin. That meeting is going on as we speak, and we shall see whether it is possible for someone of considerable political authority in a truly functioning government to nevertheless to exercise effective control over the large institutional forces that have been constructed for the government of Europe. If it turns out that it is impossible, that will be a validation of the Galbraithian view. It will be, however, a recognition of the consequences of what will happen when a long overdue stranded theory asset collapse doesn't occur. The stranded theory, having prevailed and maintaining its position, keeping its adherence in place. And I wonder, Adair, how many of those authors of that IMF statement that you found in 2006 are still in their jobs? I would bet all of them are, except by normal attrition and retirements. So the consequence when a stranded theory asset collapse that is long overdue doesn't occur is that you will get, in the end, a stranded politics institutional collapse. And that could be happening quite soon.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. And this is the last